This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Just over half of us, 53% of Americans, are now vaccinated, or at least partly vaccinated against COVID, which is fine, way better than we were, but it's still a very long way from what we need for herd immunity. And until we get there, the coronavirus can keep recirculating among us almost endlessly. The CDC now recommends vaccination for everyone over the age of 12. Young people rarely get severely ill from the virus, but of course they can transmit it along to others. I recently talked about getting the vaccine with a teenager who, for reasons that'll become quite clear, didn't want his parents to find out that I was interviewing him. Can you describe to me where you are right now? What's your room look like?
You see a piano and a guitar, and then there's my bed. Here's the rest of my desk. It's like an L shape, and then two speakers, PC. It's cozy.
Now, I know you want to stay anonymous, so what should I be calling you?
I guess Aaron Williams.
Aaron Williams, okay.
I went on a random name generator, clicked the button a bunch of times, and that's what I got.
Now, you're on summer break?
Yes. That's why my parents aren't home and I can do this interview.
I see. And so, Aaron, you weren't sure at first if you wanted to talk to us about this. What were you worried about?
I would say that my parents are good people, but I've really kind of grown tired of all the fighting and issues that we've had over simple things such as a vaccine.
Now, you're 16, right, Aaron?
Yes.
So that means that you can get a Pfizer vaccine in Arizona, but your parents won't let you. What's their concern?
Yes.
What do they tell you when it comes to the vaccine?
Originally, their concern was that the vaccine is underdeveloped and the risks aren't known. Now, what they're saying is that the long-term risks, because of it altering your DNA, quote-unquote, that they don't know about those risks. And even though my friends have taken it, my teachers have taken it, they've all been fully vaccinated for months now, and they're all doing perfectly fine. But my parents insist that in 4 years, they will all suddenly start dying because of how it rewrites your DNA.
So you've been at school or not been at school?
I've been in school in person. Last year, when COVID originally hit around March, they took us to in-home learning. Mm-hmm. But then for the entirety of my sophomore year, I've just been at physical school. Of course, with like masks and social distancing. But near the end, when most people had gotten the vaccine, they wouldn't mask up and they would just walk around not caring about social distancing. And
why is that? Well, how did they explain that to you?
What do you mean by that?
Well, your friends, you say that some of your friends would not mask up and they would wander around. Why was that?
Because they learned that it doesn't really harm them. So if they get COVID, it doesn't matter since they're going to be immune to it and they're not going to have any symptoms.
Even though they might pass it on to somebody else who it could harm.
The thing is, everybody is vaccinated.
Okay.
Pretty much everyone at my school is fully vaccinated.
Wow. So you must feel kind of lonely in a certain way.
Yeah. I think the moment that I really realized was when my friends were planning a gathering. And it was sort of kind of a video game tournament. And it was going to be at one of my friends' houses. And they originally never talked to me about it. They just left me out of it. And I only found out because I saw it from one of my friends' phones, a text message that popped up about the gathering. And then I asked about it. They said, oh, yeah, it's been this thing that we've been working on, but you can't really come since you're not vaccinated and we don't want to take our masks off. And that's when I realized that this is pretty important and I'm starting to get left out of life because of not being vaccinated.
Now, it's just to be clear, is it legal in Arizona for you to get vaccinated without parental consent?
Sadly not. Otherwise, I would have already gone and got it because there's a CVS around 1 to 2 minutes away from my house.
What's the first time you remember talking to your parents about whether you get vaccinated or not? And what was that discussion like?
I think the first time it was at night. We were in the living room watching TV and Dr. Fauci was giving a sort of speech and sort of explaining why the vaccine is safe and now it's available to most people and you should go get it. And as soon as they said that, my mom immediately said, I don't trust that. And she showed me some Facebook screenshot of someone saying that it alters your genes and it's unsafe. And I obviously went and I found the research paper that says why mRNA vaccines are actually safe. And that's when we had our first fight because it escalated. And they had been going down the kind of Trump and far-right rabbit hole for as long as I can remember. And when my teachers got it in January, I told my parents about it, and they were originally slightly hesitant, but they said, okay, we'll wait like 3 months and see what happens. We waited 3 months, and during the span of that time, they started going through all sorts of conspiracy rabbit holes, and because of that, they started changing their mind, and they pushed it back to 6 months, to a year, to 2 years, until they just said, you're never getting the vaccine.
Mm. So, Aaron, I was reading a thread that you posted on Reddit, and in it, you basically tried to figure out if there's some way for you to get vaccinated without your parents' permission. What kind of options have you considered, and can you walk me through them?
I have seen many options because many people were really helpful in that post. Most of them, without knowing what state I lived in, just suggested that I go and talk to a doctor, and the doctor would be able to sign off on the vaccine saying that with the informed consent law, I would be able to get it. But in Arizona, that law doesn't exist. Someone suggested that once I get my driving license, I could drive over to California, and some other people suggested that I would have a friend's parents take me and they be the adult because they never require any sort of proof that that person is in fact your parent. They just want an ID from them.
Now, you're not going to do anything illegal, are you?
I'm not.
Have you thought about that?
I would never do any of that because I really don't want to be breaking the law or anything similar just to get a vaccine.
Now, what would happen if school required you to get vaccinated to appear in person? Would your parents still not let you get vaccinated?
I'm pretty sure from what they've said that if they required it, I would be able to go to school and they would get me the vaccine.
Aaron, it's pretty normal for a teenager to fight once in a while with your parents, but this seems more complicated and much more painful. How does it feel to be so at odds with your parents about this?
It hurts in some ways it does, but really what they've done is they've turned it around on me and they've been saying that I'm the one hurting them, which is really funny to me because I'm the one that's suffering. They're not really suffering from not getting the vaccine. They just go to work and mask up while I'm missing out on friends' gatherings and other things at school and such, but they're saying that I'm hurting them because I'm causing stress for them.
How are they going to feel if they hear this interview?
They would think that I betrayed them, in a sense, because their idea is that they're protecting me from the COVID vaccine. And if I went and did an interview about why COVID vaccines are good, then they would feel like I betrayed them.
Now, are you worried about them getting sick since they're not vaccinated?
Yes. They're way higher risk than I am. And they've been working their part to mask up and do social distancing. But how long are you going to keep doing that? Because if they're not going to get the vaccine, then it's going to be years of them just keeping masks on. And I can already feel that they're tired of doing that, because as soon as they get home, they rip off their mask. And I don't know how they're going to keep doing this without getting a vaccine.
This is so moving to me, but it seems to me that part of the reason you've tried so hard to talk to them about the vaccine is because you care about them so much and you want them to be safe.
Yeah. I really don't have any other close living family, and they've been my parents for my whole life. Nothing's going to change that. They've grown me and they've helped me be who I am today. So I would really like for them to be able to get past this pandemic and carry on being the really good people that they are.
Aaron, I want to thank you for talking with us. All the best to you.
Yeah, thank you.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Among the many terrible long-term effects of the COVID pandemic has been the increase in homelessness. Home prices have soared as incomes have stagnated. And homelessness has reached crisis levels in many cities, including, and maybe most notably, Los Angeles. For decades, Los Angeles has had a housing shortage, but with each crisis, first the crash in 2008, and now with the pandemic, the market has become more restrictive than before. Contributor Francesca Mari reported for us on an unusual situation that's emerged there, house sitting as gig work. These are people, mostly without homes of their own, who are hired to protect empty houses that are being flipped on the real estate market.
Hey, Augustus.
Hey.
How are you?
All right.
How long has it been since I last saw you?
It's been a while.
Augustus Evans calls house sitting shelter with pay. Francesca Mari recently visited Evans in a one-story house, a double wide in Hemet, about 2 hours from Los Angeles.
Come on in. I'm gonna give you a tour of the lifestyle of your life, right? So this is the kitchen. Everything has been redone. New appliances. It's going on the market probably like in a week or so.
Augustus has been living here since December.
So this is the living room here. And this right here, I guess this right here, this is the dining room, but I kind of use this for my little office setup. got a nice, wonderful view here. You know, I'm surrounded with mountains. And it's absolutely quiet and peaceful all the time, as, you know, as it always is, you know, when I'm doing house sitting.
The walls have been painted cream and the floor is redone with wood laminate, but they sound hollow as we walk, and one window still has graffiti scrawled across it. When Augustus first got here, it was occupied by squatters.
All of this right here was junk.
Wow,
old barbecue pits, furniture, old furniture. Every one of these rooms. Broke down vehicles all around the property. The whole population here was smoking crystal meth. I mean, it was tables and raggedy furniture in every room. Fish tank all the way across.
And, fish tanks?
Yeah, aquariums, you know, one of them. The bathroom was destroyed. I had to drive a dozen people out of here. You know, half of them looked like they'd been drinking a gallon of lemon juice. But I couldn't help that because I was, you know, under instruction from the people I worked for. This right here is a bedroom here. This is one of the first bedrooms. And I use this right here for myself personally.
Why did you choose that room to be your bedroom?
Well, because I can see out that window. When I could see out that window the whole park and the whole area, because that's where you have most activity and drama coming from. And I have my little.
Oh my God! What the hell is that?
My little toy.
Oh God!
It's a weapon.
What is it?
It's a gun. It's not real, but it does look real, don't it? But see, when I wave that, if somebody come and pray, I just turn the light on and put my hand up there like that, and they stop. They run.
In his first week here, Augustus was burglarized. He lost his computer, printer, phone, and notebooks full of his writing. Being robbed is almost a part of the job. He's paid by a house-sitting outfit called Weekend Warriors, and they're contracted by a real estate company, Wedgewood. They provide security while the house is renovated, staged, sold, and inspected. It's solitary, restrictive work. He can't leave the property, only quick trips to the grocery store or laundromat, no guests. Augustus has lived in more than 20 houses in the last 7 years. 24/7 house sitting pays $800 a month. It works out to a little more than a dollar an hour.
Who are you mostly guarding the houses from?
From? The people who would break in, I would say that would be your homeless and your drug addicts.
Does it ever feel complicated for you being homeless yourself to kick out other homeless people?
No. I'm not kicking them out. I'm keeping them from damaging a property where money has been invested to improve the property and to qualify it to be purchased.
Augustus grew up in Arkansas, one of 10 children born to sharecroppers. He picked cotton as a child until his family moved to California. In his teens, he was arrested for selling heroin and landed in juvenile detention. As an adult, he tried to open a martial arts academy, but no bank would give him a loan. Then in his 30s, a friend invited him to participate in what became, at the time, the biggest bank robbery in Los Angeles history. He spent 7 years in prison for it and immersed himself in reading and writing poetry. He especially loved the trio The Last Poets.
Selfish desires are burning like fires among those who hoard the gold as they continue to keep the people asleep and the truth from being told. A racism and greed will keep the people in need from getting what's rightfully theirs. Cheating, stealing, and double dealing as they exploit the people's fears. And now Dow Jones owns the people's homes and all the surrounding land, buying and selling their humble dwelling in the name of the master plan.
Paper money. But his love of poetry, along with a felony record, didn't help him get a job.
I came out and put in applications. And it's almost like, you know, when you got to check that box down at the bottom, you know, Have you ever had a felony? And then see if you lie about it. So they got a whole list of things I can't do as an ex-con. I cannot become an insurance agent. I cannot become a real estate agent. I cannot work for no financial institution. I wanted to learn how to sell insurance and real estate. I wanted to be a property manager. And so when I go in and, you know, I fill out the application, as I was leaving out of the office, I had forgot something. So I ran back, you know, to the office. And as I opened the door of the office, I'm looking at the two people that gave me the application laughing. Oh, they're cracking up and dropping my application in the trash. And that's when ladies say, we don't hire people that ex-cons. And it dawned on me that I got dreams and visions, you know. So I said, you know what, I'm going to focus on finishing up my book. And so that's when I became dedicated to completing my book, completing my writing.
Augustus was married and he has three children. In 2010, his wife asked for a divorce. After their divorce was finalized, he put his belongings in a trash bag and walked out with no real plan other than to sleep in a train station. For 2 years, he crashed in the back room of his friend's store. Then one day, he heard about house-sitting from a customer.
He was a house-sitter, too. And he told me about it. You can live in luxury and all that, you know, until they sell it. I said, man, that sounds good. That sounds real good. He said, I'll call the lady right now.
4 hours later, Augustus was driven to his first gig, a triplex in Riverside, east of Los Angeles.
Oh, it was tore up. All three of them messed up. See, they gave me an air mattress, a refrigerator, a microwave, and $50 to buy me some food to start with. You know, I got shelter, real shelter, with pay. I was so happy to be at a place, you know, and I'm in the, and that's when my first computer was stolen. See, I know what I'm signing up for. If it wasn't for homeless people on drugs, if it wasn't for drug addicts breaking into homes, there would be no need for house setters.
Augustus works for a real estate company, but he also totally understands that real estate companies are part of what's making it so hard for almost everyone to afford housing.
This place, they're going to sell this right here for probably for $200,000, and I'm looking at it, you know, at the most $100,000, you know, is that it's actually worth. But because, you know, when you walk in there, if you notice, it's like you're walking on the waves of the ocean. Because it's a trailer house, and the cheap wooding that they did for the floor, I saw the guy do it, put it in there. They spend maybe say $10,000 to fix this up, but they gonna sell it for, you know, where they make a profit of, you know, $100,000 profit. Otherwise, why are they in the business of doing it? They know the people gonna default on the loan. They're gonna end up foreclosing. They're gonna taking it back. So the people lose their money, then interest rate on everything is sky high. And they're so greedy. You got a lot of places that's boarded up. And if they're saying that it ain't enough space, it ain't enough room, that's not true. Because you can ride miles and miles and miles, see nothing but open land, or empty space.
Yeah.
But it's what it comes down to is what kind of compassion do they have is in the heart of the people who's running things. People don't have sympathy on you when you ain't got no place to go and ain't got the money to pay for it. Yeah. And the evidence of it is 70% of the people down there of the homeless population look like me and you. And they got children out there too. And the city don't give a damn.
Since the start of the pandemic, home prices in Los Angeles and around the country have increased. many people have newly fallen into homelessness. That's startling, because already, before the pandemic, there were more than 66,000 unhoused people in Los Angeles County alone.
Do you consider yourself homeless right now?
Do I consider myself homeless? At this moment, I am homeless. I don't own a home. If there's a way to still be at peace, to still be able to contribute, still be able to raise my boys without friction, then I take that way. House sitting serves me well, you know, and I haven't had to go without being in a house for 8 years, with the exception of about 2 weeks and a couple of times, 2 days. I slept in my truck for 2 days, get a phone call, I got a house for you. What's the address? Text it to me, on my way.
Wait, so what's your plan? Like, where would you like to move?
I ain't say I'd be house sitting forever. If I look for one for myself, I'd probably end up just getting a one bedroom. I would look for something that's $1,000. You know, it don't have to be in no exclusive neighborhood if I just really want to get an apartment. I saw a house over there in Beverly Hills, you know, off of Roxbury, Cherokee. And it was actually for rent. They wanted $7,000 a month for it.
Oh my God.
One time, Augustus and I were sitting in my car, and I offered to show him how to use Craigslist so that he could search for places on his own. His only other option seemed to be getting on a list for affordable senior housing.
See how it says search for apartments housing?
Uh-huh.
Click there.
Now I have Compton here, right? What's the next thing I punch?
Just scroll.
Oh, you scroll? Oh!
That one's cute. Look at this one. This one's cute. Look at that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure. You know what? $2,000 a month? $1,500 a month, you say?
$1,000.
Okay.
Let's see if we can find anything for $1,000 a month.
Yeah, because you can't even get a single for $1,000.
No. All right. Can't get anything for $1,000.
Yeah,
sorry. So you got to get on that senior housing.
Or I got to get out there and sell me some books.
Augustus dreams of breaking into publishing.
Finally learned that there's a way to hustle and get rich legally. Sell a million books. At $20 a pop. Do it inside of a year or two. I'm going to do whatever I need to do to generate legally millions to prove that it could be done. I was born and raised a slave, but I'm not going to die one.
That idea might seem far-fetched, but he wasn't having any luck with senior housing. I followed up with him a while later, and he told me about the wait list.
You know, senior housing list is like 5 to 10 years long.
Are you going to be sad to leave this place?
No. It's all going to be the same. You know, when it comes to me, I'm still the same planet Earth. I'm on the third planet from the sun. And I'm just rocking. You feel me? So this is kind of like an experience, or a poem I wrote. Another episode, another experience, another thrill, and another year. See, as time passes us by, what can we will? Will we ever wish for the days that are rolling over our heads? Will a time ever come that we all should dread? Or will we miss the things in passing moments? It's just another episode, another experience, another thrill, and another year. When will the day come that our battle for love is won? Everybody was born to enjoy their freedom. Everybody was born to enjoy success. If this means happiness, but what do we know? It's just another episode, another experience,
another thrill, and another year.
Thank you.
Hey, man, thank y'all. Thank y'all.
Augustus Evans. When we last checked in with him, he was house-sitting in Oxnard, California, and he spoke with Francesca Mari.
Mr. Inca, come on in. Hey, Mr. Inca, you're my best friend. Please don't just stand outside. Come right on in, Mr. Inca. Yeah. You know, it's been hard for me to think, because I know I don't have no more money in the bank. I wake up in the morning facing all kinds of odds, trying to do everything I can. Find myself a job, Mr. Income. Please don't just stand outside. Come right on in. My pockets are empty and I'm ready to win. Get me a brand new Mercedes Benz and ride through the wind. Mr. Income, please don't just stand outside. Come right on in. Huh?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There she is.
Hi, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Nomi Fry writes about television and social media and pop culture in all their infinite forms. And lately, she's been writing about what's happening on reality television. So, Nomi, I know we're going to talk about reality TV in general, and it's got a kind of broad and interesting history. What was the one that first grabbed you?
I mean, probably, you know, the very first one was when I was a young teen, and it was probably The Real World, which, you know, grabbed everyone, I think, and was on MTV, and it was the first show that kind of took the premise of let's put all of these, you know, these seven strangers, as it famously says, seven strangers picked to live in a house and have their lives taped. And it was fascinating.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so that was the first show that grabbed me. And now here we are today. And actually, we've just hit a kind of historical milestone in the history of reality television, which is that The Kardashians, after 20 seasons, has finally come to an end. The last episode aired just about 2 weeks ago. And I do want to talk about The Kardashians because they were probably the most influential reality television show to present to us the gambit that everything is worthy of of documentation.
There's a lot of talk about salads.
And
I can't find my cell phone. Where's my cell phone? There's a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah. Yes. There is something calming, and I think this is generally true of reality television, but certainly of The Kardashians, of kind of letting go of your own dramas and tensions and stresses and turning to someone else's.
Right. So if I'm watching a cooking video on YouTube, that's doing that trick for me while this is doing this for you.
And for that, there is another very beloved show, and it's the Great British Baking Show, known as the Great British Bake Off.
Everybody is so nice. It's so nice to each other.
There is a very kind of by now famous moment where one of the contestants becomes quite upset because his baked Alaska didn't set. He throws it in the trash, known in England, of course, as the bin. And everyone is very shocked. He threw it in the bin.
Can I just say this guy has fantastic hair, too?
Yeah, his name is Ian.
Okay, let's see Ian. Let's click on that.
Did you have a problem with your sponge?
No.
Did you have a problem with your meringue?
No.
Did you have a problem with your ice cream?
Yes.
So where's your sponge? In there? Mm-hmm. We could have tested that.
Yeah, I know. I didn't cope with the situation very well.
I think you know that it got the better of you. It was just a moment of your life that you want to forget.
Yeah.
Is that right?
It is. I regret it.
Because, you know, we all make mistakes, and we would have liked to see that sponge.
We would have liked to have seen the sponge, but he threw it in the bin.
He was absolutely devastated.
It was a devastating moment.
What else should I take a look at?
The Real Housewives franchise. It's going on 15 years now. It's incredibly successful. And it's just a cornucopia of you know, rich ladies who claw at each other, right?
I have a theory, though, on Housewives. It seems to me, because everybody misbehaves and they yell and scream at each other and pull each other's hair and do things that seem pretty atavistic, and it seems like a way to watch something so that you feel superior to them. That they're acting very badly, and then therefore you feel, okay, I'm not that. I'm not doing that. I'm behaving better than that.
I think that's definitely true of reality television in general, of a lot of reality television, where it's probably not the nicest thing to admit that this is something that we would like to see. But yeah, but it's like going to see like going to the boxing ring, right? Going to see the fight. Like, what's that about, right?
Fair enough. But
I mean, just, you know, but there's also sympathy there, David. There's also sympathy.
There is?
It's not just, I think so. Yes. There's you find yourself identifying yourself with some of them. So a good way, I think, to enter into this universe is The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. It aired during the pandemic. And my colleague Doreen St. Felix wrote a really excellent TV column on it. And one of the things she pointed out in it, which I agree, is that it's interesting to see how the Real Housewives franchise has kind of like marched with the times, right? So there are some much more kind of au courant discussions of race that are starting to enter into the show, which is quite interesting. And okay, so there are two characters. One is a Black Pentecostal woman, and she is a leader in her church. And her nemesis this season is Jen Shah, who is Polynesian and Muslim. And in the clip we're going to listen to, Jen Shah is recounting this skirmish they had to her husband, who is Black.
Mary all of a sudden freaks out and says, "I would never say the things you say. You're a hoodlum."
I'm so sorry, honey.
I was like, "What is wrong with you? Like how you you say, oh, if I go to a 7-Eleven and there's Black people, I go to a different 7-Eleven?" Baby, I was so hurt. Because guess what? That's my son, my nephew, my family that's at that 7-Eleven that you won't go to because you're too...
These are kind of important conversations that are happening, but they are also used as a cudgel in the kind of power play that happens anyway among these ladies. It's just that the discourse has changed. So I think it's a really interesting and kind of like new way to think about the housewives, as kind of incorporating these conversations into their usual conflicts.
Do you have a last pick for us?
Yes, I do. So one last show that I think is fascinating. I've watched it some. I myself want to watch more of it, but there's just so many seasons and so many spinoffs. It's been hard to catch up. It's called 90 Day Fiancé, and it's on TLC. And The concept is that these are couples. One of them is American, the other one is from another country. And the idea is that the foreigner comes to America to be with their betrothed, I guess, or at least girlfriend or boyfriend. And they have to get married within 90 days because those are the conditions of the K-1 visa. And so the stakes of the drama here are bureaucratic, right? Which is kind of amazing because it's the drama of everyday life and it's about normal people. We were going to watch a clip in which a character who's from Tunisia goes to talk to a lawyer to understand what marrying his American girlfriend might
get married within 90 days. If you don't want to get married, you're going to have to leave the United States.
I want to know how long time it will take till I have that, I don't know how to say it, the green card.
Now, sometimes it could be a few months or 8 months, 10 months, a year. It just depends.
But I don't know why it takes so long time.
There's a lot of fraud, and the immigration folks are concerned about that.
So that's kind of straight up drama.
Yeah.
It just seems, even just talking with you this brief time, that the range of these shows is a lot greater than I had any idea of, that it wasn't just kind of my mind taking a vacation and watching people look for their cell phones or wallpaper their walls.
Yeah, I mean, there's that too, and it has its place.
Sure. But does it affect you? Does it have greater power in your view as a reality show as opposed to scripted drama?
Not necessarily. Each of them has its own power, I guess. There is something quite affecting about seeing, and you know, problematic often, about seeing real people suffering, mm-hmm. you know, confused in dire straits, and while all the questions about the kind of ethics of it still stand, and these are things that I ask myself, and sometimes I feel like some shows cross some lines. I do think that looking at people, you can really learn a lot. You know, people look to television, whether it's scripted or not, to tell them about how life is lived.
The New Yorker's Nomi Fry. You can read her on reality television and much more at newyorker.com. Now, I want to take a few moments to acknowledge the death of someone who's been so important to The New Yorker for so long, a master of nonfiction writing, Janet Malcolm. Janet contributed her first piece to the magazine in 1963, and she was a staff writer until her death this month. She wrote about whatever captured her interest, photography, psychoanalysis, fiction, biography, and all the complicated questions that arise from these forms. No one ever looked harder. No one ever looked with more acuity at the profession of journalism itself. Janet's book, The Journalist and the Murderer, is an essential text about the complicated, often deceptive dance that takes place between the reporter and the reported on. A decade ago, Janet spoke at the New Yorker Festival with Ian Frazier, one of her close friends and colleagues. She was 76 at the time and still writing at the very highest level, publishing astonishing personal essays, profiles, and critical pieces. And she kept doing so until very recently.
So, Janet Malcolm.
Here's Ian Frazier with Janet Malcolm in 2011.
I just spent the last while, over the past actually months and weeks, reread everything of Janet's, and it really is fun, if you haven't had that experience, to start chronologically up until Iphigenia in Queens. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is, or I want to ask Janet about, is Iphigenia in Queens. The first question I want to ask you about it begins in a very dramatic way. It begins when the attorney for this woman, whose name is Marina Borukova, who was a doctor who lived in Queens and was accused of hiring a hitman to kill her husband, and she was on trial with the hitman, the accused hitman, together. And in the piece, Janet begins with the moment when the woman's lawyer puts the woman on the stand. And an entire story that preceded it somehow has to be accounted for and included in this woman's testimony. So why did you begin there?
Well, I didn't begin there when I first began trying to write the piece. I had many false starts, and none of them took me anywhere. And then this one, and I think you must find that too with your leads, as we call them in the trade, that the ones that take you somewhere become the lead. And then, or maybe you haven't had that experience. Maybe yours just comes from your head.
No, I know. You'll look and see something looks better as a lead, and it's well into the piece, maybe. But did you begin chronologically earlier than the
moment? I began with the prosecutor's narration of the story, which was, he narrated it very well himself, his version of it. But it didn't go anywhere. That's my criteria for beginnings. If they kind of peter out, then you haven't got the right one. Whereas if they keep going, you got it. And this one kept me going. And also, it was a very interesting moment.
Right.
And you want to interest your reader.
I mean, she was the most interesting thing in the piece, and she was one of the most compelling characters you've ever found, I think. She was just later on in the piece, where she's kind of been humbled, and you say she looked like a captured princess in a Roman triumph parade, and suddenly you really see this woman. She wears her hair in a kind of a turban, and she's very thin, and you also compare her to a young student revolutionary in Moscow, so that when you start with her, it's really powerful, but then you do have to fill in the details of what's gone before, and what you do is it combines with the plot, in that the plot of this trial hinges on the judge, who is just a complete idiot. And it's so great to just watch an idiot. And Janet's description as she begins, the first thing she says about Judge Hanafy is his name. Hanafy is a man of 74 with a small head and a large body and the faux genial manner that American petty tyrants cultivate. Just the strength of doing that, because he has to go on vacation. So he has to go on vacation, and as a result, he stops granting sidebars where the lawyers come up to talk to him because it takes too much time. And so with the sidebars, then, you were able to fill in all the details. I went through, I saw each sidebar was about some other important moment, and by the sidebars that are granted and the sidebars that are denied, you managed to fill in these back.
Of course, the sidebars are the parts of the trial that the spectators don't hear, but they're transcribed. So by then getting the transcript afterwards, and this, I think, is a very crucial step for a writer covering a trial, to get that transcript in order to get the sidebars.
You said that as you went along in this trial, that you understood Marina less and less. Do you feel that you understand her even less now, or how did that sort of happen?
Yeah, she was mysterious. And certainly when I interviewed the jury, it was clear that they didn't understand her at all. The jury was just completely turned off by her, that aspect of her that you we're getting at with the barbarian princess image. I mean, she was just, they said she was cold and aloof and obviously not a good mom. And they all but said, that's why we convicted her, because we didn't like her. I was quite shocked that they were so frank.
You do such a great job portraying nuts.
and,
you do the best nuts of any journalist I've ever seen. And you stay with the nuts as they get nuttier and nuttier. And there's so many of these kinds of lost soul, delusional, nutty people in your pieces. Trevor Thomas, the last person to see Sylvia Plath alive, is a character in your book about Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. And you describe him so wonderfully. I wonder, when you see people like this, do you have literary models in your head? Are you thinking of like a character from Gogol? Are you thinking, how do you see them when you first see them?
Well, in Trevor Thomas's case, when I stepped into his house, which was a, you know, a Collier's Brothers place with just this most incredible amount of stuff in a kind of almost sickening profusion.
And the dust.
And the dust on, you know, there was so much dust, you felt there was kind of dust on top of dust.
Dust with its own, yeah.
Its own dust. But anyway, I immediately did think of that Borges story, The Aleph, which has something to do with some, that there's a man who kind of sees everything in the world is in his mind. He has that kind of a grasp, and I had that feeling of here was everything in the world, and also here was a very nice ending for my book.
Well, the description of this guy's apartment is just so great, because you've seen chaos. You see it. It's the main thing you see really in life, and. Yet, you just, your mind goes blank and doesn't describe it. And you said, about the chaos in his apartment, you said, this is the way things are. This is unmediated actuality in all its multiplicity, randomness, inconsistency, redundancy, authenticity. Before the magisterial mess of Trevor Thomas's house, the orderly houses that most of us live in seem meager and lifeless, as in the same way the narratives called biographies pale and shrink in the face of the disorderly actuality that is a life.
Yeah, I used to write well.
Thank you very much.
Janet Malcolm, who died earlier this month, was in conversation with Ian Fraser at the New Yorker Festival in 2011. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline. Our story about Augustus Evans in Los Angeles was produced on location by Mike Dodge Weisskopf of KCRW, with post-production by Destry Maria Sibley.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.